Plot It Yourself by Rex Stout. Copyright 1959 by Rex Stout. This recording of the full-length reading of Plot It Yourself was published by arrangement with the estate of Rex Stout and was produced in 1996 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. This book is read by Michael Pritchard. Chapter 1. I divide the books Nero Wolfe reads into four grades, A, B, C, and D. If, when he comes down to the office from the plant rooms at 6 o'clock, he picks up his current book and opens to his place before he rings for beer, and if his place was marked with a thin strip of gold, 5 inches long and 1 inch wide, which was presented to him some years ago by a grateful client, the book is an A. If he picks up the book before he rings, but his place was marked with a piece of paper, it is a B. If he rings and then picks up the book, and he had dog-eared a page to mark his place, it is a C. If he waits until Fritz has brought the beer and he has poured to pick up the book, and his place was dog-eared, it's a D. I haven't kept score, but I would say that of the 200 or so books he reads in a year, not more than 5 or 6 get an A. At 6 o'clock that Monday afternoon in May, I was at my desk, checking the itemization of expenses that was to accompany the bill going to the Spooner Corporation for a job we had just finished, when the sound came of his elevator jolting to a stop and his footsteps in the hall. He entered, crossed to the oversized made-to-order chair behind his desk, sat, picked up Why the Gods Laugh by Philip Harvey, opened to the page marked with the strip of gold, read a paragraph, and reached to the button at the edge of his desk without taking his eyes from the page. As he did so, the phone rang. I got it. Nero Wolfe's residence, Archie Goodwin speaking. Up to 6 o'clock, I say Nero Wolfe's office. After 6, I say residence. A tired baritone said, I'd like to speak to Mr. Wolfe. This is Philip Harvey. He'll want to know what about, if you please. I'll tell him. I'm a writer. I'm acting on behalf of the National Association of Authors and Dramatists. Did you write a book called Why the Gods Laugh? I did. Hold the wire. I covered the transmitter and turned. If that book has any weak spots, here's your chance. The guy who wrote it wants to speak to you. He looked up. Philip Harvey? Right. What does he want? He says he'll tell you, probably to ask you what page you're on. He closed the book on a finger to keep his place and took his phone. Yes, Mr. Harvey?
Is this Nero Wolfe?
Yes.
You may possibly have heard my name.
Yes.
I want to make an appointment to consult you. I am chairman of the Joint Committee on Plagiarism of the National Association of Authors and Dramatists and the Book Publishers of America. How about tomorrow morning?
I know nothing about plagiarism, Mr. Harvey.
We'll tell you about it. We have a problem we want you to handle. There'll be 6 or 7 of us, members of the committee. How about tomorrow morning?
I'm not a lawyer, I'm a detective.
I know you are. How about 10 o'clock?
Of course that wouldn't do, since it would take more than an author, even of a book that rated an A, to break into Wolfe's 2 morning hours with the Orchids from 9 to 11. Harvey finally settled for 11:15. When we hung up, I asked Wolfe if I should check, and he nodded and went back to his book. I rang Lon Cohen at the Gazette and learned that the National Association of Authors and Dramatists was it. All the dramatists anyone had ever heard of were members, and most of the authors, the chief exceptions being some scattered specimens who hadn't decided if they cared to associate with the human race, or had decided that they didn't. The Book Publishers of America was also it, a national organization of all the major firms and many of the minor ones. I passed the information along to Wolfe, but I wasn't sure he listened. He was reading. That evening, around midnight, when I got home after taking a friend to a show, A Barrel of Love by Mortimer Oshin,
Wolf had just finished his book and was making room for it on one of the shelves over by the big globe. As I tried the door of the safe, I spoke. "Why not leave it on your desk?" He grunted.
"Mr. Harvey's self-esteem needs no sop. If he were not so skillful a writer, he would be insufferable. Why curry him?"
Before I went up two flights to my room, I looked up curry in the dictionary. Check. I won't live long enough to see the day when Wolf curries anybody, including me.
Chapter 2 At 11:20 the next morning, Tuesday, Wolf, seated at his desk, sent his eyes from left to right and back again, rested them on Philip Harvey, and inquired,
"You're the spokesman, Mr. Harvey?"
Since Harvey had made the appointment and was chairman of the committee, I had put him in the red leather chair near the end of Wolf's desk. He was a middle-aged shorty with a round face, round shoulders, and a round belly. The other five were in an arc on yellow chairs that I had had ready for them. Their names, supplied by Harvey, were in my notebook. The one nearest me, the big blonde guy in a brown suit with tan stripes, was Gerald Knapp, president of Knapp and Bowen. The one next to him, the wiry-looking bantam with big ears and slick black hair, was Reuben Imhoff of the Victory Press. The female about my age, who might have been easy to look at if her nose would stop twitching, was Amy Wynne. I had seen a couple of reviews of her novel, Knock at My Door, but it wasn't on Wolf's shelves. The tall, gray-haired one with a long, bony face was Thomas Dexter of Title House. The one at the far end of the arc, with thick lips and deep-set dark eyes, slouching in his chair with his left ankle on his right knee, was Mortimer Osham. He had written the play, A Barrel of Love, which I had seen last evening. He had lit 3 cigarettes in 8 minutes, and with 2 of the matches he had missed the ashtray on a stand at his elbow, and they had landed on the rug. Philip Harvey cleared his throat.
"You'll need all the details," he said, "but first I'll outline it. You said you know nothing about plagiarism, but I assume you know what it is. Of course, a charge of plagiarism against a book or a play is dealt with by the author and publisher, or the playwright and producer, but a situation has developed that needs something more than defending individual cases. That's why the NAAD and the BPA have set up this joint committee. I may say that we, the NAAD, appreciate the cooperation of the BPA. In a plagiarism suit, it's the author that gets stuck, not the publisher. In all book contracts, the author agrees to indemnify the publisher for any liabilities, losses, damages, expenses." Reuben Imhoff cut in.
"Now wait a minute. What is agreed and what actually happens are 2 different things. Actually, in a majority of cases, the publisher suffers." "The suffering publisher," Amy Wynne cried, her nose twitching. Mortimer Osham had a comment, too, and 4 of them were speaking at once. I didn't try to sort it out for my notebook. Wolf raised his voice.
"If you please. You started it, Mr. Harvey. If the interests of author and publisher are in conflict, why a joint committee?"
"Oh, they are not always in conflict." Harvey was smiling, not apologetically. "The interests of slave and master often jibe. They do in this situation. I merely mentioned en passant that the author gets stuck. We deeply appreciate the cooperation of the BPA. It's damn generous of them."
"You were going to outline the situation?"
"Yes. In the past 4 years, there have been 5 major charges of plagiarism." Harvey took papers from his pocket, unfolded them, and glanced at the top sheet. "In February 1955, McMurray and Company published The Color of Passion, a novel by Ellen Sturtevant. By the middle of April, it was at the top of the fiction bestseller list. In June, the publishers received a letter from a woman named Alice Porter, claiming that the novel's plot and characters, and all important details of the plot development, with only the setting and names changed, had been stolen from a story written by her, never published, entitled There Is Only Love. She said she had sent the story, 24 typewritten pages, to Ellen Sturtevant in November 1952, with a note asking for suggestions for its improvement.
It had never...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?